or Estonian or Hungarian, even though they have a separate history, or Basque. And Basque is spoken between France and Spain in a region that covers both of those countries. Basque is an isolate. Basque has no living relative. We assume that there were many languages like Basque that once coded Europe, but now Basque is all alone. And yet Basque ends up sharing in some of these European traits, even though Basque certainly has roots completely separate from Proto-Indo-European or the Uralic ancestor. So there are these commonalities that you find. So when we look at this kind of situation, it's becoming clear that there is a grander story of how languages develop. And there is especially good work being done by R.M.W. Dixon on this. He has a book called The Rise and Fall of Languages, which I highly recommend. It's written to be accessible to the highly interested layman, and it has the blessing of being, well, short, and therefore not that expensive, and something you can fit into your life. So if you're interested in the language area phenomenon, Dixon's book is useful. What he argues is that the typical situation worldwide for languages is that a great many languages, including from different families, are occupying space and people are not moving around. This is the early hunter-gatherer situation. So each language is generally spoken by a relatively small group of people, and these small groups are arranged on the planet in a patchwork, and people are not moving, migrating, conquering. That's something that becomes necessary when you go from the hunter-gatherer stage to the agricultural stage. You start planting things, more people live, your society gets bigger, you need more space. Technology begins. Next thing you know, you're moving because there are too many people for the land. And if you move, well, there were already some people there, so you're going to interact. A lot of the interaction is not going to be pleasant. Next thing you know, you're subsuming various peoples under large arrangements. Next thing you know, you have a nation. Next thing you know, you have an empire. That's all very new. That's rather recent in human history. But at first, people were just kind of stewing together. Their languages were stewing together for millennium after millennium after millennium. While they were stewing together, we assume that because contact between people, and there was contact, tends to lead to language mixture, that they were sharing words, they were sharing grammar, and that languages, and even language families that were spoken close together, started to become more and more alike. And this is what Dixon calls linguistic equilibrium, the idea being that this situation just continued. So languages were becoming more alike. We see something like this today in Australia. I've mentioned that in Australia there is so much sharing of words, particularly because of intermarriage between tribes being regular, that it would be almost impossible to trace back what the Proto-Australian ancestor looked like. Well, these are cultures that were indigenous, preliterate ones, and so they reflect what we can imagine was something closer to the original state of humanity than people in tall buildings having therapy in a first world Western society. So then you have the invasions and the migrations and sometimes even geographical upheavals, but especially just developments of humankind over the past 10 to 12,000 years. And that leads a group of people to move to another region, to move far, far away from where they were before. And what this involves is replacing the languages that previous inhabitants spoke, or it involves more mixture with those languages, but in particular, it replaces them. And what happens then is that you have a language which is free to develop along its own way in a way that was not possible when the language was just in a hive buzzing around with other languages. When you have the equilibrium situation, then major change in the entire type of grammar is unlikely because all the languages keep affecting each other. No language is going to go off on its own way. Rather, all the languages are going to come to be more and more alike. That's, for example, the Sinosphere. But once a group of people end up going way off into the desert somewhere or way off into the forest, then it doesn't have its friends to keep it in check, so to speak. It starts coming up with its own private jokes, you might put it that way. So next thing you know, you've got a very, very different language. As the generations go by and there's no contact with the hive, and since language always changes, you've got this brand new thing. And so that would explain the development of something like Proto-Indo-European. Proto-Indo-European is generally thought to have started in some kind of hive, this being in the Middle East or in what's now Turkey, very controversial, southern steppes of Russia. Wherever this was, there were a great many other language families buzzing around, as there still are in that region. But then, when Indo-European speakers moved, for example, west into Europe, well, it wasn't in the hive anymore, and so it was free to become this very separate thing. Next thing you knew, you had this proliferation of a whole new Proto-Indo-European family. And that's assumed to have happened relatively quickly. So Dixon calls this, in contrast to linguistic equilibrium, punctuation, the idea being that something happened quickly. And he's modeled this idea on a similar theory of evolution, which has been propounded by the late Stephen Jay Gould and Niles Eldridge. And the idea in their theory, which they call punctuated equilibrium, is that evolution is not necessarily a painstakingly slow process, but that actually new creatures appear rather suddenly. And their idea is based on the fact that in the fossil record, you do not usually see a very, very incremental growth from the little tiny five-toed horse to today's horse. What you see is jumps. Five toes here, then three toes, and then bang, an enormous horse. Not quite like that, but that's the model. So that idea is being extended to language theory in this term, in terms of punctuation. So Dixon's theory seems to be acquiring a certain amount of influence, and it shows that language areas is the default situation. That's what languages ordinarily do. And then it's a rather novel situation for a language to kind of stick its head up and move and really go into a new direction. So as you would expect, in today's world, you would find many concentrations of language traits among families, particularly in what you might call the less developed parts of the world. And so you have in the Amazon a Sprachbund like that. Most speakers of the Sinospheric languages are indigenous people. Chinese is an exception in this case. And the language that is a Chinese one that is spoken in the widest way is Mandarin, which is not part of the Sinosphere. And so then you have other languages like English and like Mandarin Chinese and like Arabic, which are spread across vast parts of the globe. That's not the way any language would have been at the dawn of human history, or for most of human history. The idea of Arabic being this massive splotch, or English being this behemoth on the map in terms of where it's spoken, is something new, and that's based on the emergence of what one might call civilization. And that is the novelty. The language areas are the normal situation.
Lecture 23, Language Develops Beyond the Call of Duty.
There are sculptures and decorations on the top of many Gothic cathedrals, and they're very tall buildings, and these things were put there at a time when there were no airplanes or helicopters, and almost no human being was ever going to be in a position to actually see these decorations that a whole lot of work was put into. It was said that these were put there for God. But, of course, in another perspective, we can look at this as almost overly decorating. It seems almost like something that's going on its own energy. It's almost mysterious that that much effort would be put into it, which means that the cathedrals were built not solely for functionality, but there was a great deal of decoration. Language is like that too. Language tends to develop far beyond what is necessary, and we need to understand the nature of that before we go on to understand what, for example, pigeons and creoles are in later lectures. So the basic idea is that a grammar consists of a whole lot more rules and sounds, usually, than it actually needs. Language is overgrown. So if we go back to our bush analogy, a typical human language grammar is an overgrown bush. It grows much further than it would really need to. You could say there was a wheat and a chaff, but that implies a certain judgment. Some people would say that there's a core and then there's a periphery. And that's the way grammar generally is. And this is the kind of thing that becomes clearest when we take a quick trip around the world and get a perspective on what a language could be, all you would really need, versus what a language really is. We have to get a sense of the overgrowth. So one example is the have construction that I talked about in the last lecture. If you say, I have walked to the store, then this is something that isn't only rare, but it's really not necessary. And so, for example, in The Seagull, the Chekhov play, there is a line at the end, which is Konstantin Gavrilovich has shot himself. And this is a typical kind of ending for a Chekhov play, where somebody talks about how happy they are, then there's a shot off stage, and of course then everybody is very, very sad. And this one is typical in that somebody kills himself, and that's what we carry home with us. The English translation is that Gavrilovich has shot himself. In the original Russian, it's just Konstantin Gavrilovich shot himself. Now, the has shot himself is designed to imply that an action in the past still has repercussions in the present. That's the difference between shot himself and has shot himself. But that's a very subtle kind of difference. As I said in the last lecture, that is not what would immediately occur to you if someone who was a foreigner asked you what the difference was between I have walked and I walked. And it's nice to have, but certainly the Russian version of the play, the original, is a complex and nuanced document without having to indicate that someone having shot themselves 5 minutes ago is an event that still has repercussions in the present. Of course it does. We'd be very hardened people if that were not true. Russian doesn't mark that nuance. English does. But it's unnecessary. For a language to develop, say, marking of the past, that seems to be normal because we live in the present and then there's what happened before and what will happen. It's part of being human, we would think, to mark those distinctions. But to mark that something happened in the past and still has echoes in the present right now, that's getting really picky. That's the sculpture of the angel on top of the cathedral. You don't need that. You just happen to have that. So the language moseys into corners like that. I've analogized it to my cat at times. A cat just crawls into things. For example, I'm taping in this studio. In order to do this and come from New York, I had to leave my suitcase open on the bed while I was putting things into it. For some reason, Lara likes to get into the case. She's seen me do that hundreds of times over the past 8 years, and yet she always has to climb into the case and then look at me as if to say, I'm surrounded by four little walls. I have filled this open space. And she seems to find a kind of triumph in that. Languages are like that. If you open up a suitcase, the grammar will plop its way in and look at you and lick its nose. So that happens all around the world. My favorite example of this is what's called evidential markers. That's a kind of a boring term for something that really is kind of interesting. In a lot of languages, for anything you say, you also have to indicate how you learned this fact, whether you heard it in some languages, or even more in many languages, whether you heard it, whether you saw it, whether it was gossip. You have to indicate that. And it's not with a phrase, it's with some sort of ending. And so just like we say walked, if we did some walking in the past, then we have to indicate it with the ED ending. For them, you also have to have an ending indicating source of information. So I can say, oh, I saw that they were tearing down the building. But I could also say just, they're tearing down the building. I don't have to say I saw it or I heard it. But in some languages, for me to not say I saw that they're tearing down the building would be as incomplete as someone saying they tearing down building. You have to do this. So, for example, there's a language in the Amazon called Tuyuca. And Tuyuca is a good example of a language with these evidential markers. So if you want to say he's chopping trees, then the sentence is kitigiti. And that's all you have to know. Kitigiti. That means he's chopping trees. That's also an incomplete sentence. That's baby Tuyuca. For example, if you heard that the trees were being chopped, so it's like, then you say kitigiti gi. And the gi means that you heard it. Now, gi does not mean ear or hear or listen in the language. It's just a little ending. But when you say gi, that means that you heard it. So, kitikati gi means I hear that they're chopping trees. But then, if it's that you saw it, then it's kitikati e. And that means, if you come and announce that, that it's implied from that ending e that you actually saw the trees being chopped down. Then, if you're not quite sure that the trees are being chopped, so that you're saying what in English would be, well, apparently he's chopping trees, then it's kitigitihoi, and that's your ending. And if it's a matter of hearsay, if you've heard it around that trees are being chopped, then it's kitigitiyi. And so these are the endings. And important to realize that they're just endings. And so if we say walked, that ed ending is not a word past. It's not a word yesterday. It's just itself, ed. These endings are the same way. They have endings to indicate how you hear things. And in Tuyuca, this goes on and on. There are different ones according to whether it's you talking or whether you're talking about somebody else. There are ones for the present and ones for the past. It's very much part of the language. So if you had, for example, Broadway musicals are translated into many languages. To my knowledge, none of them have ever been translated into Tuyuca. But if they did Annie Get Your Gun in the Amazon and they wanted to make it accessible to Tuyuca speakers, then when they got to the song, They Say It's Wonderful, in English, it's, they say that falling in love is wonderful, and they say. In Tuyuca, it would be something like, they say that falling in love is wonderful, it's wonderful, yigi, and there'd be that ending. But we don't have that in English, and so it's structured differently. Now, how does that happen? You know, how does the cat get into the suitcase in this case? It happens by grammaticalization. We talked about that in a lecture a long time ago. So something that starts out as something concrete that you can take home and feed or pat becomes something grammatical that just basically directs traffic within the grammar, like the ED past ending. So, for example, there's a Native American language called Maka. And to say that the weather is bad, then your basic sentence is wikitsakak, and that's, it's bad weather. But that's also baby maka. You can't just say wikitsakak. You have to add an evidential ending. And an evidential ending example would be pid, which means from what it looks like. Like you see that it's bad weather. And so, wikitsakak pid. That's what you have to say. Now, the pid today is just an ending. But originally, at an early stage in the language, what pid meant was it is seen. It was a verb. Now, what started out as something concrete, a nice verb meaning to see, which could be rendered as it is seen, has now devolved into being an ending. It's hanging on to another word, and it's a piece of grammar. And so, wikitsakak pid, it's bad weather, it looks like, that evidential marker. So, grammaticalization is often the source of this overdevelopment of grammars. Sometimes what grammaticalizes is a marker of negation. So we saw what happened with pas in French. But sometimes what grammaticalizes is an evidential marker like this, where it's something that's nice to have, but it is not necessary. Languages overdo it. They're not driven towards any particular limitation to functionality. There are all sorts of things they do that are not functional at all. Another example of this is possession. Think about the way we use have. You can say, I have a couch, and you probably do, and you probably bought it, and you had it put in your house, and you possess that. That is something that is, you know, on your insurance. Then you also say, I have a mother. If you think about it, that's a different kind of having. You don't have your mother. You didn't buy her. You didn't choose her. You're not insured for her. You don't have your mother. It's rather that there is a mother in relation to you. And that's a very different kind of concept. Now, in English, we just say have. And if I point it out, we know that there is a difference. Even something like, I have an ear. Well, yeah, but you couldn't avoid that ear. It was never separate from you. You have no control over what kind of ear you have. Really, it's more like there's an ear on you. Many languages make a difference with that little nuance. So there's the kind of having where you are in a relationship of ownership with something that's separate from you. Then there's the kind of having where it's on you or in you or about you or inherent to you. It's very different. So in Mandinka, in West Africa, to say your father, you say Ifama. And that's basically you and father. And that means your father, Ifama. Now, there's only a marker of possession if it's something that you own in a more distant sense, like, for example, a well. And so kolongo is well. And to say your well, you say ila kolongo. And that marks that you do possess this thing. It's different. Now, when it's your father or when it's your ear, then that is called inalienable possession. You cannot be alienated from those things, or if you are, it's a big deal. You're forsaking your father, you're Van Gogh. That's a big deal. But really, those things are just with you forever. Then, if you're talking about a well, or if you're talking about a couch, or if you're talking about a bag of dog food, then that is alienable possession. You can, if you choose, alienate yourself from those things. So a language that has developed inalienable possessive marking, or alienable possessive marking, is a language which has kind of taken things too far. You don't need that distinction, and the way that we know it is because we who speak English don't even think about that distinction. But the fact is that there are a great many languages in the world that have that. If you're a linguist and you're studying an unknown language, your ears are pricked for that. You know, chances are the language, especially indigenous languages, is going to have some difference between the way that you have your table and the way that you have your sister, because they are very different concepts. And context takes care of it, but a language might decide to be very picky about it. Another example of how far languages can go is something that has bedeviled anybody who has gotten to the higher levels of learning a Romance language or a Germanic language. And that is the way they use the reflexive. So, for example, if I say I wash myself, that's easy reflexive. It means that I am performing an action upon myself. I'm not washing the cat, I'm washing myself. That's basic reflexivity. So, that's pretty easy. But if you learn many other languages of Europe in particular, you find that the way they use their reflexive pronouns is not limited to that. So, for example, we sit down. But in Spanish, a person says, yo me siento, I sit myself. Now, we know technically in English that if we sit down, it's not the person across the room who we're making sit. We're doing it to ourselves. And we can say, I seat myself, but we'd rather not. We just sit. But in Spanish, yo me siento, I seat me. And all sorts of things in Spanish that are like that. In French, when you get angry, it's je me fâche. I am angering myself. And that doesn't mean that you're making yourself angry. It's that the getting angry is something that happens inside of you, and so in a way it's an action performed upon you. And so je me fâche. I'm getting angry. You don't say je fâche, because then somebody wants to know, who are you fâching? The idea would be, I made someone angry. You get angry, you fâche yourself. And so I anger myself. In German, if you remember something, you remember yourself. So ich erinnere mich. We don't remember ourselves. In French also, je me souviens, I remember me. Because the remembering is something that happens inside of you. Now, what this is reflexivity going further. It makes a certain sense to imagine that if there's some emotional state you have, that it's something that you're doing to yourself or something that's operating upon you, so that when you talk about it, it's something that you're doing to yourself. It makes sense, but obviously it's not necessary. You very rarely find yourself seating somebody who is not a child. So when you say, I sit down, there's no ambiguity. You're not going to ask somebody who says, I sit down, oh, who are you sitting down? Obviously, they're sitting their own hindquarters down into the sea. Now, language might choose to dot every I and cross every T, and many of them, particularly in Europe, do. This is another one of those European aerial features, though. Once you get out of Europe, this kind of reflexivity fetish is much rarer. But the typical European language does that. In Russian, if you're tired, you tire yourself. It's happening in you. And it goes on and on like that. Some people call this inherent reflexive marking, the idea that you have to mark overtly any shade of reflexiveness in something that's going on. And that is something which a grammar does to excess. When that happens, you can't look at it and think that's the way it must be. That's a distinction that must be marked. We certainly wouldn't say that because we don't mark it. And if you understand that languages go too far, then you're in a position to understand gender marking, which is something that any English speaker has fought in learning most of the other languages that we tend to be exposed to. And so, in European and many other languages of the world, nouns are divided into these gender classes. And it's the sort of thing that hits you on the second or the third day and, you know, kind of separates the men from the boys, the women from the girls, whether you want to grapple with this. And so in Spanish, it's el sombrero. So a hat is somehow a boy. And then a house is a girl, la casa. And Spanish is pretty easy on you because you've got the O and the A to go on a lot of the time. But then in French, you know, it's le bateau, the boat, and the boat's a man. La maison, and the house is a girl. And it's not really about the endings, and it gets a lot harder. German has three of these genders, and so it's easy if something is inherently masculine or feminine to figure out that it's going to be in masculine or feminine, but then there's a neuter. And we don't spontaneously divide up people or things as men, women, and some other thing. And that gives you your first clue that there are going to be some problems. And so, for example, the spoon, the fork, and the knife in German are der Löffel and die Gabel and das Messer. And so, for some reason, the spoon is a man, although I always thought that physically, if anything, the spoon looked kind of like a woman to me. But for them, the spoon, you know, has facial hair. And then the fork is this, frankly, rather intimidating woman. And then Messer, the knife, is somehow some advanced or, you know, different kind of person. So, that's German. This is clearly not necessary. There's no reason for there to be gender-differentiated silverware. That's not cultural. It's just one of those things that languages develop because they can and they do. Now, why would a language do that? Obviously, it wasn't that one day German was like English, and then the next day somebody decided, ha, you know, spoons have testosterone and, you know, forks have estrogen. It was something that happened very gradually in a way that made sense to people at each step and then led to a situation today where what you've got is fossils that really don't make sense. But if you're a child and you are not yet old enough to have lost the ability to learn language as well, you can pick it up before you know what an unnecessary imposition is being made on you and rebel. That is how complexity is passed on. So the stage one in a situation like this is that there are languages where instead of there being a prefix or a suffix for this, there's a whole word that you use before a noun. And all the nouns in a language like this are divided up into classes. Often the way nouns are divided up is based on whatever particular spiritual or animist conception the group of people have. So there's an Australian language called Djerbal. And in Djerbal, there are these four noun classes. And any noun has to be preceded by this other word. So there's a class which is men and animals. Then there's another class which is females. Then there's another class for food that isn't flesh. And then there's another class which is kind of miscellaneous or other. So the word for man is yara. But you can't just say yara. You have to say bayi yara. Bayi is a separate word, and that indicates that we're in this men and animals class. Then girl is gabai, but you have to say balan gabai. And so there's bayi for men and balan for girl. And then if you have cake, well, that's not flesh. Then that's gaiga, that's cake, and it's balam gaiga, so balam. Then wood, which is other, is yugu, but you have to say bala yugu. So that's the first stage, that you have these separate kinds of words. And so it's kind of like man-man, and then there's non-flesh cake. It starts like that. Now then, as we've seen, very often what starts as a free word erodes and becomes a prefix, if it's before a word, or a suffix, if it's after a word. You can almost expect that, especially with words that don't take a whole lot of stress, like these bayi balan balan bala words. So as time goes by, separate words like this that mean something like men, women, animals, things that are long, things that are fat, or things like that, start to become prefixes and suffixes. That's grammaticalization. So there are other languages where you see something like what's going on in Djerbal, except it's with prefixes, and the prefixes alone don't have any meaning anymore. So Swahili can have seven genders in a way, and it's because of these noun classes. And so the m prefix means that something is people. So mtu is a man. Mtoto is a child. Now we imagine that at an earlier stage of this language, just tu was man and toto was child. The m started out as some kind of free word. Now it's just a prefix. Then there's an animal class, and the prefix is n. And so ndege is bird, nzige is locust. So you have these patternings. So that's the next stage. But then, as we've seen, as languages change, you tend to get mess. So, for example, there's sound change, which tends to obscure things. Then there are cultural changes. There are eccentric semantic switches that you have to just reconstruct later, like the one for sister-in-law in Indo-European that we saw, where the word, for some reason, originally was masculine, even though the typical sister-in-law is not a man. Things like that happen. As time goes by, languages get wounded in various ways. And so, as a result, after a while, a language like Swahili, which has relatively tidy noun classes, is just going to have this situation where some words have a certain prefix or suffix, some words have a different one, and well, you can call it masculine and feminine, or feminine and neuter, or you can call it Laurel and Hardy, you can call it Abbott and Costello, you can call it anything you want to. It's just different patterns. It no longer corresponds to anything in the world in any real way. And there's where you get the multi-gender silverware. There's where you get the idea that a house is a girl and that a hat is a man and things like that. And then you just have to deal with it. And so there'll be all sorts of things that really make no sense at all. In German, Mädchen, girl, is neuter, which somehow implies that a girl doesn't have a sex yet. Well, obviously she does. You just have to know. So, this is the way that languages nose into spaces that they don't need to. There is a myth, and we will talk about this myth not long from now, that what makes one language different from another is the culture of its speakers. So many people would look at these things and say, well, it must be something about their culture. And although there is a link between culture and language, we do have to stop and consider, what is culturally indexed by a male spoon and a prancing fork and a kind of knife that sits on the sidelines. I've met Germans, and that has nothing to do with culture. I have eaten with Germans, and I've held up the fork, the knife, and the spoon and asked, do you see any kind of genderedness in these implements? And they say, no, it's not cultural. A lot of these things are just due to chance. It's the way language moves along. Languages always make sure that you can communicate as a human being. But then they're always in a kind of an overdrive, and they do things that they don't really need to do. Now, sometimes when an argument like this comes up, people justifiably ask, how do you know what a language needs? How can a person from one language say, well, that language doesn't need evidential markers, etc.? And indeed, there is a potential danger that we are taking our own language view. I don't want to say worldview, because that gets into that mistaken language culture nexus again, but our language view, and then imposing it on others. And so it has to be clear that our idea here is that it's not that a language doesn't need something when English doesn't have it. There are times when that is the case. If there's a language with evidential marking, well, people who only spoke that language and decided to found linguistics, if it hadn't been founded in the Western world, might say, well, the first thing that a language needs is these markers showing whether you heard it or saw it. But then, once they encountered other languages where that wasn't there, they'd have to let that theory go. So, indeed, you can say from English, that's cute, those evidential markers, but that's not necessary because we have no such thing and we don't seem to be tripping over our shoelaces. But then, on the other hand, it's important to realize that English is full of things that aren't necessary, too. So remember that I mentioned the have perfect. We have that. That's not necessary. We have our definite and indefinite articles. That's not necessary. In fact, the ground zero of language is something which does not, to anybody's knowledge, exist. It seems that there's no such thing as a language moving through time that does not accrete a certain amount of gunk. But there are languages that are much closer to it than English. For example, I talked about how you need to be able to say that something happened in the past and something happened in the future. Actually, no, you don't. Now, one would think from English, and even being a person, you know, as we sit swathed in bitter memories and dreading the future, we think, well, of course, there must be the past. There must be the future. No, there are languages where there is no way of indicating past and future at all in a regular way. Context takes care of it. And if you think about it, it usually does in our lives. You could not use any indication of tense. You could talk only in the present tense and rarely have people wondering, are you talking about in 2014 or are you talking about something that happened in 1985? It would always be clear. You know, I'm wearing bell bottoms and throwing out my fondue set and still rattled over what happened to Nixon. Obviously, that's not 10 years from now. And so, we have a way of saying that something is in the past, but that's just a frill, and that's a frill that most languages have, but you can go with some languages in New Guinea, for example, where they just don't. Now, if they want to be explicit, they can say, well, in 1985 this happened, or they can say many yesterdays ago, but they don't really have anything like that. Another one is, you would think that you have I, you, he, she, and you would assume that, well, of course, there has to be we and then you for the plural and they. There has to be a way of indicating more than one I, because a we is two I's, if you think about it. It's like I and then I, eyes. And then he and she, not just he, but they. Nope, that's a frill. There are languages where all they have is basically I, we, you, maybe one of you, maybe two of you, and kind of like he or two of you. That's what they translate as. Basically, first person, second person, third person. Now, if you want to be explicit, there'll be some fancy words like, well, you know, the several he's or something like that. But that's only if you really need to be explicit. It's not really necessary. You could point to two people and say, oh, he did that. And context is important. You know, everybody is sitting right in the room. So, languages basically overdo it. Languages go too far. It is the nature of language to be replete with features that are utterly unnecessary to communication, fascinating though they may be. And this has a lot to do with what happens to languages as time goes by, when they come into contact, and when they're learned incompletely.
Lecture 24, Language Interrupted.
Now that we've seen that languages are more complex than they need to be, we can look at something about language contact that is not often thought a whole lot about, even in academia, but which is very important. And that is that when languages come into contact, not only is there mixture, but often this complexity gets broken down. Language contact tends to keep languages from overgrowing as much as they would otherwise. And another way of looking at this is that language complexity is correlated with the degree to which languages have come into contact and what kind of contact there has been. And the way to understand this is to look at some extremes. But basically, there are no simple languages. And languages aren't simple even if they don't have the long tables of endings that we're familiar with from European languages. So, for example, the rule of thumb is that if a language doesn't have endings that we're familiar with, then chances are it's going to have tones, and often a lot of them. And that's a different way of being complex. Then there are the numeral classifiers, like two head of cattle. Then there are the evidential markers. Then there's the inalienable possession and all the other features that we see. There are many, many ways for a language to be complex. It's kind of a grab bag, and any language grabs from at least some of those features, and usually quite a few. So that's basic. However, there's a truism in linguistics, which I think is gradually breaking down, but still students are exposed to it, which is that all languages are equally complex. If you look into language study, you're highly likely to find somebody quite authoritatively saying all languages are equally complex. And so if English doesn't have as many endings as German, we have a wrinkle like the fact that we have to say, do you want to go to the store? He didn't go to the store. He does do that. That use of do is very peculiar in English. So it's often thought that for some reason languages balance out in terms of complexity. But then notice that I've mentioned often that there are 6,000 languages in the world. All of them are not even documented in any real way. No linguist has occasion to study thousands of languages. Generally, when it's said that all languages are equally complex, it is not an important point. You'll usually find it said in an introduction or something. And really, no linguist has looked at every language in the world to assess that. That's usually said because it's a kind of politically correct view of languages, especially since most of the world's languages are spoken by people who are not in tortured, first-world, overdeveloped cultures like ours. But the truth is that all languages are complex. They're not all equally complex. And this is becoming clearer and clearer to a small group of linguists who are actually looking at the issue. And for whatever it's worth, it's natural to think that the more advanced a society is, the more complex its language will be, when in fact it's the opposite. If you're dealing with a society that has to be reached on a very small road, and then you're cutting through the forest with a machete, and you go, and they're in a clearing, and there are only 300 of them, and they point at helicopters in fascination, that sort of thing. That group is likely to have a language so complicated that you cannot imagine anybody being able to actually speak it. If you're talking about a language that's spoken by people with tall buildings and sending text messages over their phones and watching television and going to bars, chances are that language, as languages go, is relatively streamlined. All languages are complex. The most complex ones are spoken in far-off places by small, obscure groups of people. So, let's take an example of that sort of thing. There is a language. There's a language in the Caucasus region of Asia, in the mountains, and it's called Tsez, T-S-E-Z, Tsez. Tsez is spoken by about 14,000 people. Tsez is basically an oral language. It isn't written much. It's a spoken language, small group of people. You've probably never heard of them. This is the sort of language where your antennas immediately go up. You know this is going to be a nightmare. This is going to be a very hard language. And indeed it is. So, for example, just sounds alone. If you have a language that's been learned as a second language by a whole lot of people, then chances are that it's not going to have very many sounds that are hard to pronounce. And that's because as you get older, older meaning, say, over 13, it gets hard to mimic exactly the sounds in a language that you encounter. And on the other hand, if you're talking about a language where very few people have ever learned it from the outside, then sounds are allowed to ingrow like toenails, and they get more and more specific and complicated because only babies learn the language, and babies have these amazing skills of language acquisition. So it says, not only has the easy sounds like the buzz and the kuz and the ez and the ahs, but it has all sorts of sounds that are relatively rare in the world's languages that are harder to produce and harder to mimic for adults. So, for example, there is a word for to be afraid, and the way the word is rendered, and of course, my tzez is rusty. You know, we spoke it at home, but, you know. So, I, of course, am going to approximate this, but the word for to be afraid is, and that's literally the way it goes. So it starts out with not a glottal stop like the as in uh-oh, but it's further back in the throat. So it's like that. And so the first segments of it are, then the next consonant is what's called a lateralized fricative, and it's kind of like that. So it's not a l, it's not a r. It's not a childish sound. It's, and you just do that. And so, and then there's a glottal stop. So you have to make the difference between, and so it's, and that's the word for to be afraid. And that's an ordinary word. Nobody in says giggles at that word. That's normal. These are the sorts of sounds there are. And it's full of this sort of thing. All sorts of sounds made there. For example, there are various sounds, not just one, various sounds made by wobbling your uvula. That's that fleshy, pendulous thing in the back of the mouth that is funny in a cartoon. Well, that can be used to make sounds. Now, some of us are probably capable at a party of wobbling our uvula and entertaining the toddlers. Most of us aren't. If you are a Tzezian, you have to wobble your uvula all day long, every day. So, in addition, Tzez has gender. Not just two, not just masculine and feminine, not just three, like in German, you have four. And the four genders include a masculine class and a feminine class, but feminine isn't only things in dresses. It also contains objects that are flat or pointed. Now, presumably there's some reason why in the early spiritual system of the Tzez. No one knows now, but papers, pencils, and women. You just have to know. Then there is a gender that has animals and other stuff. You just have to know. Then there's another gender that just has a whole bunch of stuff, and it's just kind of the grab bag. And the gender marker is not attached to the noun, but it's attached to the verbs and the adjectives or the adverbs that are associated with the noun. And so, for example, a mother is usually feminine. So if you want to say that the mother was afraid, then what you say in the word for mother is any. Then you say any, and then you put your y gender marker before the word for afraid. And we just met the word for afraid. And so the mother was afraid of is any, no. And that's how you do that. Then if you're the son, then you're in the gender class where you use a b prefix. And so buk bainosi, the sun rose. And then if the day warmed up, the day is in the grab bag class, and that has an r that you put before the verb. So tatanu rudi ro. Oh, and the little two sounds there were uvular. I'm not a uvula wobbler, but something like, oh, and these are different sounds. So if you can wobble your uvula, that's good. But then these people do it in many subtly different ways. So that's it says. And then there's another weird wrinkle. The gender markers only happen when the word begins with a vowel. So if the word begins with a consonant, then the rule is that you leave it off. So girl happens to be kid, not as in kid, it's just an accident. But if the girl knows, then the kid, yes, and you have the y. But if the girl believes, then it's just kid, and then bojiji yo. There is no y because it begins with a consonant. So the rules get that picky. In a way, the exception is the rule. So it has gender, but then you only mark the gender when the following word begins with a vowel. This is a very complex language. Now, when that person tells you all languages are equally complex, usually they don't know anything about Tzeze, and Tzeze is part of a whole family of languages just like this. Clearly, there's something different here than in English, although English is complex too. Tzeze, of course, has case markers too, so we've got the kind of Latin thing. But they tend to be very irregular. So in English, we have irregularities like child and then children. And there's no reason, you just kind of have to know. You have goose and geese and person and people. But there are only so many words like that. There are no new words like that. Once you learn the group of words that are like that, and how often do you talk about a goose anyway, you don't find that there are new words coming into the language where things like that happen. So there's a fax. The plural of it is not fex. You know, it's immediately faxes. All new words just take the good old s. But in Tzeze, this kind of irregularity is all over the place. So the word for fish, and I chose a word without any of these sounds, so no more, is just besuro. Besuro, fish. That sounds like some Spanish word. Besuro. So, besuro is fish. Now, if you want to say that something belongs to the fish, if it's the fishes, then, believe it or not, it's besuros. You know, this is another one of these odd little English parallels. So, that's good. And then if you want to talk about fishes, although usually in English the plural is fish, then it's besuro bi. Now, that's a regular noun in Tzeze, but regular nouns in Tzeze are almost the exception. Tongue is giri. Now, it should be that if you're going to talk about the tongues, like the tongue's surface, then it should be giris. But no, it's girimos, and that mo just comes from Mars. It's just there, and you have to know. There's no reason. And then tongue should be, if fishes is bepsurobi, then tongue should be giri-bi. But instead, it's giri-ma-bi. And not mopi, like before with the tongues, just ma. No reason, you just have to know. The word for water is hi, like that. Now that's fine. But then, waters is not lis, but it's las, for no reason. And then waters is glidabi. And lots and lots of nouns do that sort of thing. And of course, a Tzeze speaker doesn't think about it. But this sort of thing is very important in speaking the language and makes it very difficult to learn the language. Then, Tzeze has something else which I could not let this whole course go by without describing, and so this is a good place to slip it in. It's something very common in languages of the world, but quite foreign to a European, and it is this. There are languages, and Tzeze is one of them, where there are two different kinds of subject. On the one hand, if you say, the girl washed the dress, the girl is really doing something. She's bending over and washing that dress, and the dress comes out cleaner. But if you say, the girl knows, well, it's a subject, but she's not really doing anything. For one thing, there's no object, and she probably can't help knowing. If you ask somebody, what are you doing? They don't sit and say, I'm knowing. You know, what are you doing? I'm thinking. You know, those are things that just kind of happen. Whereas you would say, I'm washing the dress. In many languages, that difference is important. And so if you're an active kind of subject, then the subject gets an ending, which it does not get if you're just kind of sitting there knowing. And so if the girl knows, then kid, yes. And that's it. Kid is just all alone. The kid sits by herself knowing, kid. But then if the girl washes the dress, and washes the dress is geresaisi, then instead of kid geresaisi, it's kid ba geresaisi. And that ba just means that she's a subject that's really doing something, really affecting something. You're painting something, you're kicking something, you're cooking something, you're washing it. But that has to be marked. That's called ergativity. And a great many languages in the world are ergative. That's normal to a great many people. To us, a subject is a subject. But to many people in the world, that is really kind of like chopping a tomato with a machete. You have to specify what kind of subject. Now, this is another way in which languages overgrow. Obviously, that's not necessary, but it is something very common in the languages of the world. And Tzeze has this. So obviously, Tzeze is a very, very complicated language. And yet, people speak this every day without effort. You would literally imagine that nobody could speak this and do something else. You'd assume that if anybody could do it, then they couldn't cook, you know, they'd have to stop walking. It'd be this feat. But no, they walk around doing it. You imagine they're Tzez drunks who are laying in the Tzez gutter speaking this language, you know, slurring, but still using all these endings, etc. That is quite amazing. Or also the old joke about the person who goes to France and marvels that even the children speak French. Well, there are Tzez kids, 7 and 8 years old, running around. And for them, none of this is at all difficult. This is what real languages are like. Tzez is a little extreme, but just a little. And a great many languages are like this. You go somewhere, and there might be a hint in the back of your head that it's going to be boonga, 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 because it's a culture that doesn't have tall buildings. But no, it's going to be this sort of thing most of the time. It's been said that the Native American languages Cree and Ojibwa are so complex that children don't really speak the language till they're about 10. And so even when you're 8 or 9, you're still, it's not goo-goo, but you haven't really got the whole thing till you're 10, as opposed to English speakers, where by the time you're 6, you're pretty much talking and nobody has to slow down. You've got the idioms. You've got a sense of humor. It takes longer in many of the smaller languages of the world. So that's what a language is. Then there is what a language can be on the other extreme when contact comes into play. So, an example of this, which has only gotten around in any real way over the past few years, is one dialect of Indonesian. Indonesian is spoken, by the way, in Indonesia. And it's a dialect called Riau Indonesian. And Riau Indonesian is spoken in a region of the island of Sumatra. And it is a bizarrely simple language. Now, standard Indonesian seems normal. It's got a rather complex kind of prefixation and suffixation. It has a variation on active versus passive, which is quite counterintuitive to the newcomer. So standard Indonesian is quite normal. But while Tzez makes you wonder how anybody could speak it without having an aneurysm, with Riau Indonesian, you wonder how anybody could speak it and be understood, because there's just so very, very little in it. So, no endings. You know, no endings of any substance. No tones. There are no articles. There's no word order. You can put things in any order you feel like it. Context will take care of it. There is only a little bit of indicating things in time. Really, for the most part, they leave tense unmarked. You might want to say already, or you might want to say tomorrow, if explicitness is desired. And they've got a couple of markers, but they don't use them very much. And so it's not as extreme as the New Guinea example that I talked about before. But it's close. There's no verb to be. The same word means he, she, it, and they. So there's just this one third-person word. Very, very little. And so context is everything. I mean, you almost think that nobody could speak this language unless they basically were standing right in front of somebody having all the same experiences, mirroring their movements like Lucy and Harpo Marx, because everything is context. So, for example, ayam is chicken, makan is eat. So ayam makan. This is becoming a mildly famous example in the linguistics world. It's the chicken eat example. So ayam makan. Now, that can mean the chicken is eating. It can mean that the chicken ate. It can mean that the chicken is going to eat. It can mean the chicken is being eaten. It can mean that the chicken is making somebody eat. It can mean somebody is eating for the chicken. It can mean that chicken over there that is eating. It can mean where the chicken is eating. It can mean when the chicken is eating. It can mean how that chicken eats. Ayam makan. All based on context. Because, let's face it, spoken language tends to be bound in context. You don't usually stand in a valley and shout out ayam makan. Presumably, if you utter that sequence, there's a chicken somewhere interacting with food in some way, and you were all looking at it anyway. So presumably you can get away with that. But still, it's a very unusual state for a language to reach. Now, why would that be? Languages always complexify, as I've stressed, and so there's no reason why some language would basically run into the ground the way that one had, unless something unusual had happened. And it wasn't an asteroid, it wasn't a controversial election count or anything like that. It was actually learning this language as a second language. That is what did it. It's spoken in a region where people who spoke various languages related to Indonesian have come together over the centuries. And what this has meant is that Indonesian has been being used much more as a second language than as a first language in this area. Just like we sweat through our language learning classes, the adult anywhere in the world has trouble with some.